This podcast is brought to you by Learn Prime. Hone your development skills at learn.thoughtbot.com.
Giant robots smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. My name is Ben Orenstein. I'm here today with Marc-André Cournoyer. How are you doing?
Very good, yourself?
Good. So you sort of got your start in open source, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, I did quite a lot of project. I tried to get into open source for multiple times with smaller project. Back in the days when I was doing like C Sharp, I was in a .NET community. And I kind of got into a big open source project at a time. I think it's still there. It's called Monorail. And as you can guess, it was a port of Rails to .NET. And Active Record 2. So I kind of recoded the code generator for Rails into that language. And so I got into the, I got a commit as a committer into the project. And that's how I got my official, if you want, like a big start in open source. So I got accepted as a committer because I made one contribution. So, but still, I still have my name on that page now. And I was very proud of that. And that's how I got started. But I guess most people know me because I wrote my most popular work has been Tin, the web server. But I did multiple things before that, right? Before I got that project that became more popular, like the .NET world. I also was in, did quite a few projects in classic ASP, right? So that was an awful language, but still like it was missing lots of tools. So I was just, I would just like port the tools I would see in Ruby to those languages that I was forced to use at my job.
Yeah. Which is a good trick, actually.
Yeah. So when you're getting started and you're in the language that you ate, like the, just porting things that from other language is amazing, right?
Yeah. So and you don't even need to have the original good idea. You can just
exactly,
bring it over.
Exactly. Because initially, I find that's the thing that is hard. When you're getting started, you don't know. Like a lot of people want to get into open source. They say, oh, I'll just contribute to Rails because they don't have ideas. They don't know what would be a successful project. So just porting a project from a different language is a very good way to get started. So it's true for business, right? It's true for open source too. So
absolutely. Imitation is fine.
Yeah.
So you started off as doing all this open source, and then you quit your job and started selling learning materials, I guess you could call them.
Well, there's a lot that happened between the time that I did the open source project, and I tried multiple times to start a business and failed.
Okay.
In different ways. But I get started in selling products, info products mainly, was with my book, How to Create Your Own Programming Language. I wrote that book maybe like 6 years ago, something like that. So I was still at my job. And my goal was not really to quit my job with that. I was just, I just finished reading like the 4-hour work week. You've read that, I guess most people have. And usually when I read those types of book, I try to apply what I read from there. So I read the Muse chapter in which he describes how to test an idea and see if it works. So I did exactly that. And I bought some AdWords. Maybe if you remember from the book, like he suggests like buying AdWords for maybe $200, something like that. And just testing if your idea can get a few conversion. So I did exactly that. And I did get a few conversions. So I said, hey, what the hell? Like I get maybe like 4 signups.
And this were like people that gave you their email that said, like, let me know when this book launches?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was horrible landing page. Like, but it was like 6 years ago, it was kind of, it's not like today. Like today you see like a new ebook each week or so, even like a few, a handful each week. So it's pretty crazy. But back in the, well, back in the day, like that's 6 years ago, it's still not a big time, but still it was not the same thing for ebooks. Trying to sell an ebook online was a lot harder. But with that sell page, the turning point for me was that people saw that I was charging money. So it was pretty clear, like the book was maybe $30 or something like that on a landing page. And people did click and then enter their real email. So that was a big moment to me. Like I would realize, wow, I can myself ask money online. Those people don't even know me. And I just like the page was awful. It would just say like, I'm going to write a book that tells you how to create a language that has indentation like Python. That was my big selling point, like indentation like Python. And like not a lot of people, but just a handful sign up. And that was the big kick in the pants for me to say, hey, let's just do this. Let's try to write a book, even though was never wrote a book before. And my English is not far from perfect, especially your written is a lot more awful than my spoken. So you can imagine. But I did it and it was a relative success for me at the time.
Yeah. So after you got those signups, you said, okay, I'm going to go through and do it. And you did. How long did it take you from that point?
I think I spent maybe a month, all the nights, trying to write the book. Maybe a little bit more, because it was very hard for me to try to understand what should be the logical order. Maybe if you've tried to go into programming languages, you've heard about the Dragon book. Have you heard about this one?
Yeah, it's like the compiler book.
Yeah, the Dragon book. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's 1,000 page long. It's a big book. It's an impossible to finish unless you're forced to finish it.
Right.
So I thought, I'm going to write a shorter book because I don't have any choice, because I cannot write a big book. So I ended up being very short. I think it was 60 page long at the beginning, or even shorter than that. And I started reading stuff about marketing and sales online, and they recommended like bundling with other stuff, like a screencast and other stuff if you can. Mm-hmm. So I tried to, instead of selling it as an ebook, I kind of sold it as a system, right? So I add a few screencasts, bundle it with source code for different programming languages. And I had something else that I forgot initially. A forum, which didn't work out as well as I expected. So I removed it. And that's how I ended up selling it at $40, I think, initially.
Gotcha. Is it still selling today?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. Almost as much as initially. And the reason for that is because I have affiliate marketers, people selling it for me, and they get 50% cut. So you can go on the site right now, you go at the bottom and you can sell the book for me. I'm going to give you 50%. That's how affiliate marketing work. Mm-hmm. But I was very lucky because one of my first affiliate was Peter Cooper.
Uh-huh.
Right. Yep. So, and
it was a huge audience.
Huge audience. And he was really, I think we were, both of us, me and Peter, we talked to exchange a few tricks initially about marketing. We were both kind of into the internet marketing thing, and we tried to find some ways to promote products. And obviously he had a much bigger audience than me. So he kind of was trying some, I guess he was trying some tricks with my products, and he ended up being very good success.
Mm-hmm.
And also approach other Giles Bucket was to one of my affiliates. So I had some pretty big names, right? So that's how we got started.
So when did you actually make the jump of doing this full time? Was it after that book, or had you made other products?
After that book, no, I was still at my job, but we kind of all, it was a startup. So I've been part of the startup community. I was in the startup community in Montreal here for about maybe 5 years or so, something like that. So we got laid off from the job, right? A few months after I wrote that book. And what you do after you've been laid off from a startup is, in your part of the startup community, is you try to start your own startup, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what my friend and I did. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know anything about business. So the product we built was called Talker. It was a kind of a copy of Campfire, but improved, kind of an improved Campfire.
Mm-hmm.
But the sale didn't come in, right? So we did $200 in the first 2-3 months. So it was okay. But for us, in our eyes, we were expecting like to make a living out of this in 1 month, right? We said, hey, in 30 days, we're going to pay yourself a full salary and be very rich and whatnot, and without doing any marketing or whatnot. So that's what our idea is. And we got to add a big deception there. On the plus side, we did manage to sell it at a decent price. But we use all of our savings at the time to build or to sustain ourselves to reach that point.
Yep.
And when you sell your company, it takes a bit of time before the money comes in. So we had to get a job. So I did get a job at another startup, which I didn't really like, but I used that time to learn everything that I could about marketing and sales, because I knew that was my big weakness at the time. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know anything about marketing and selling. So I spent that whole year at that startup learning about marketing and selling. Mm-hmm. And so that's where, at the end of that year, almost the same day, I think, I said, okay, I just quit my job without any product idea. And I say, all right, so I'm just going to quit, and then I'm going to figure some way to make a living out of this. So doing the same thing that I did with my book, but just at a much bigger scale that I can pay myself a salary and sustain me and my family.
Hmm. You spent a year learning about marketing and sales. What were the biggest things you took away from that?
My biggest takeaway is that marketing and sales has been around for a very long time, right? So we have not, like the internet marketers today, or the social engineer, whatever they call themselves, have not invented anything. They're just reusing some of the same principles that have been there forever. So I didn't enjoy any of the recent book or whatnot, but I did enjoy a lot of the old books. Like on one of the more recent one was called Influence by Robert Cialdini.
Yeah, that's good.
You read this one?
Yep.
Yeah, it's amazing. I love it. But I also read much older books like Claude C. Hopkins. What was it called? Scientific Advertising or something like that. Mm. But it's kind of was written in the 1920s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's very a good book. But when you read it, you realize he's using the same tricks like people talk about today, like in marketing. And you see in those blog posts, like 10 ways to blah, 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 blah. Those are just remash principles that they knew back in the day. So if you study how people have been successful back in the day, you can mm-hmm. just reproduce that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any tips from there? Like, how would you summarize some of those ideas?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway from influence from Robert Cialdini, he has some principles in there, like in the book. Those are the principles that I use all day. I try to keep in mind all the time when I build a sales page or like try to launch a new product. But the two main ones that I think a lot of people forget about that have been very successful for me are urgency and scarcity. Mm. What a lot of people do is they launch a product and they say, oh, okay, I just finished my ebook. You can buy it now. And they expect people to come in huge ways. Maybe if you launch something, because it's new, it's going to work initially. But it's not going to work as great as if you put a lot of urgency. Mm-hmm. So it's not the point is not to force people to buy, it's to force people to make a decision now. Because if they go on your sales page, you've made all this work to get them to your sales page. If they don't buy now, they're going to go away and never come back again, unless you get their emails. But that's another story. Mm-hmm. So you have to put a lot of pressure to say, make a decision now. So usually what I do is I limit the quantities. You can do a discount, all that sort of stuff. So that was a big help for me at the beginning when I initially got very successful with my classes.
Gotcha. So what was the first thing you did when you decided to go full-time with info products?
So it took me a few days to figure out what I do. So I did quit my job and I didn't have any idea what I would be doing. So I don't remember. Oh, yeah. So I got the idea from Amy Hoy. Do you know Amy mm-hmm. Hoy and yep. Thomas Fuch? Fox? I'm not sure I'm pronouncing
Yeah, not sure either.
And so they were doing a JavaScript masterclass online. So I thought that was a pretty good idea. And it seemed to be right. very successful. Mm-hmm. Like, well, Amy is very successful in everything she's doing. So I just said, oh, I'm just going to copy that over and do it with something that I know. So I don't know JavaScript, but I know Rails. So I did a Rails class something that I didn't want it to do. I didn't want it to do something that was for beginners. So mm-hmm. I thought maybe I'm just going to try to do a class for advanced programmers for Rails.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got the idea with my first class called Owning Rails.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a lot of help from Peter Cooper, once again, who helped me launch my class. So I did contact all the affiliates that helped me promote the book and ask them if they were interested in getting a cut and promote my class.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that up front. And so I got a kind of a big push initially with the class because of that. And it sold out, like the first time that I did the class, it sold out in 24 hours or less, something like that,
mm-hmm.
because of Peter Cooper mainly. So
yeah.
It was no magic there, but thanks a lot to Peter Cooper once again.
And so what was how much was the class?
I think it was 400 something, which is over 2 days, 4 hour each days.
Gotcha. And this was like you like talking live to the group of students, basically?
Yeah. So it's talking live to the group of students. It's kind of what we're doing now, but I share my screen and I use Adobe Connect,
mm-hmm.
Which is okay for that kind of stuff. So, and I record everything and mostly I do live coding. So lots of live coding during the class. So the Owning Rails, my idea was that I'm going to just reuse the same way that I use usually for learning thing is that I'm going to recode Rails. Mm. And then on the second day, we're going to use that knowledge that we gained by recoding Rails to learn to dive into the source code of Rails.
Hmm.
I did have to polish that idea quite a few times, but the concept is still the same today. It has evolved quite a bit, and it's been very successful.
Hmm. I noticed you don't have any upcoming masterclasses scheduled. You have two others besides the Rails one. Are you moving away from that now that you have the Great Code Club? And can you talk about that?
No, I'm not really moving away from it. But yes, I've been doing that for 3 years now, so just
taking a break.
Well, maybe, yeah, taking a break, I guess. But also with anything, the popularity is going a little bit down. So I'm kind of, well, I guess you guys know too. You guys have several products and whatnot. So at some point, like, maybe it's not, I guess it's not the same thing. I don't have any like SaaS product or let you sell on a recurring revenue, but the Code Club is the first one that I have.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen like for any info product, like there's going to be a curve, right? So it's going to start to fall off at some point. So you can see it where it starts to fall up. So if that's your main revenue, you have to find another idea before you hit that too low of a level.
Yeah.
Do you guys have noticed that too with your product, with your infoproduct or your learning courses?
Yes, definitely. Okay. It trends low over time. We've seen it takes us a surprisingly long time though. Like with our Backbone book, which is our most successful book by far, like it still continues to sell. I wouldn't say like strongly, but regularly. So I think as long as your topic is something that people are going to continue to be interested in, I guess it probably comes down to market size. Like people are still picking up Backbone, I think, and still using Rails and need information on that. And so we sort of got lucky, I guess, and chose right and chose a thing that a lot of people went into and then sort of continued to keep going into and are maintaining apps that are in and things like that. So we've seen demands for that stay fairly strong.
Yeah.
But in some of our other books where we haven't chosen as well, possibly, it's like that it falls off faster for sure.
Yeah, but you think maybe it's sometimes you pick a good technology, right? That has been, it stays important or active, I would say. I'm looking for the word there, but you know what I mean? Like it's some technologies go out of fashion. So it's kind of a, like I've been lucky that because all my courses have been about things that have been around for a long time. So like Rails, programming languages, and Node, they're still around. But I guess if I chose a technology, I don't have anyone in mind, but like that goes out of fashion, you're kind of doomed.
Right. Because if your market shrinks, if you're a shrinking market, then it's going to be trouble for you.
Exactly.
But with the programming thing, like your programming book, how to design your own programming language is perfect. Like that's always up to date in a way. Like because you're creating a new thing, and that's a great topic. It's applicable to programmers from any language, really. It's not just like, oh, this is for Rubyists. This is for Java people. It's just for anybody that wants to do it. So I think that's a really good topic, I think, for an ebook that you want to sell for a long time.
Yeah, I guess so. That was not the objective initially, but I got lucky on that side.
Mm-hmm.
But I've definitely seen like people get stopped by the idea that I use Ruby in the book to teach how to, we use Ruby to rebuild a language.
Mm-hmm.
And some people are kind of bummed by this too. Oh, can you rewrite the book in JavaScript or in Python or in C, blah, blah, blah. For, I say, oh, maybe, but it's kind of hard. I try to use Ruby, but just a very simple syntax. Like you don't use the procs and that types of things. So that's what I tried to do in the book.
Yeah. It's amazing how sensitive people are to that. Like if it's not in their like favorite language, they're really turned off by it. And like there's this book that I recommend to a lot of people called Growing Object-Oriented Software Guided by Tests, which is an awesome book about doing test-driven development and object-oriented design, and the language that it's written in is Java. And I'm always don't ignore the fact that it's Java. Like I know that you're not a super fan of that language, but like there's really good information in here. And it's tough for a lot of people to look past that, and some people just will dismiss it outright.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Similarly, like we have like a course on like doing test-driven development. And like test-driven development is basically all about the process, like learning how you do, like when do you write the test, when do you come over here, and learning the techniques there. In our test-driven development video, it's like they're using Rails, the instructor's using like Rails 3.2 or something like that. And people are like, oh, I saw it wasn't Rails 4, and so I'm not interested. And it's like, that's the least important part of the video. And so like we're updating it anyway because, you know, people want it. But people get very hung up on, you know, language of choice, you know, version numbers, things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You have to plan for that, right? If you want to create a product or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, people always want the latest version. That was the same thing with my Rails course. Everything that I teach in there is not specific to any Rails version, but I did have to update it to Rails 4 and Ruby 2, although it doesn't make any difference.
Right.
But you use that to promote a new version. You say, hey, a new version out.
Right, exactly.
Rails 4.
Yeah, so I mean, kind of we'll certainly do that. So, you know.
So it's a give and take. So
it's hard to argue with what the customers want. Sometimes you just got to give it to them.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So how is the Great Code Club going?
It's going great. It's going great. There was a big spike in subscription initially, I guess, because the Great Code Club is people subscribe. Each month I give them a new project to work on. For example, the first one was to build a 2D game, was to rebuild Pong. Latest project last month was to build an emulator, so a virtual machine to implement a very old chip called Chip 8, so you can emulate, like run some ROMs, like a Super Nintendo emulator, that sort of thing.
Yep. So you choose a project each month.
Yes.
Like, I want you to code this.
Yes.
Yeah, so in any language.
That's the pitch. No, in JavaScript.
In JavaScript, okay.
I do present the project in JavaScript. But the goal of this is to get people to code their own version. So, you know, either if you're a beginner, what I recommend people to do is just try to port my code to a different language. Or even like if you're just really getting started, just try to rewrite in your own style or whatever in JavaScript, the same as you're watching the video. I also provide the code. I think that's a good way to get started.
Okay. So you say it's the beginning of the month. Here's Pong. I wrote it in JavaScript. Here's a video of me walking through the code and explaining it.
Yeah.
And then you say, you know, either, you know, rewrite it in JavaScript, rewrite it in your favorite language, you know, add some features. You just say, like, just hack on it, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lesson video, very short lesson video at the beginning, explaining the basics that people need to know before they jump into the project. And then there's a live coding or screencast session in which I recode the thing.
Gotcha. But, so they can watch you build it from scratch.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's cool. So that's the whole point, because that's what I like. That's what I like to do. And I also that's how I learn things. So that's how I want to teach things too. So,
yeah, me too. I'm a huge fan of the live coding element as a way of teaching developers. And I'm sort of known for preaching the virtues of that a lot.
Yeah, I love it. I love it very much. And I love doing it too.
Do you basically just turn the camera on and code it and say, and then, like, you know, ship them the recording, or are you doing a lot of practice runs first?
Yeah, you know, that's the thing that I've been trying a new way of doing things. And I'm curious what you do too, because what I've been doing with my classes a lot is that initially I would practice the code a lot. So I did the same thing initially as I would do for preparing for our conference, let's say, right? So when you do that, you have to prepare yourselves to, if you screw up, you have to get ready, have a plan B or something like that. So I did that. I did recode the project several times, 10 times, 20 times, sometimes. It took a lot of time for the classes that are very long. So I would just record. And when I did videos, I would just do the thing in one shot. So recording the thing, if I screwed up really, either I would start from the beginning or, well, I would just start from the beginning all the time.
Okay.
So it's very time consuming. But yeah, at the same time, I kind of like the vibe that I get from this, because sometimes I would get excited, right? I would code a part and I would say, oh my God, so we got it. Like, it's working. People would see it evolve and would see my reaction.
Yep.
And now I'm kind of moving away because I have to produce a new video and I'm trying to up the quality too. I do now voiceovers where I record the code, my live coding session, and then I do the voiceover and do some editings and freeze frames and whatnot. I like doing it too. It's taking me less time, but I kind of feel I get less excited because, I don't know, there's something that I say, hey, it was more exciting maybe in my voice or something that when I was doing everything in one shot, and now it seems less exciting, but I feel like the quality is better. So people say, hey, they feel like it's better quality, but I feel less exciting. I don't know.
That's interesting.
What approach do you use? You do voiceovers or one shots?
It sort of varies. So, like you, if it's for a conference talk, I will do it dozens or, you know, more of times, because I want it to go very smoothly, because I know I'm time limited and I'm in front of a bunch of people and I know it's a high pressure situation. But we had an interesting experience recently. So we record a weekly video show called The Weekly Iteration, and often we will actually write code on it, do live coding. And we had an episode where we got stuck for a good 10 minutes. And the show is supposed to be about 30 minutes maximum. And we, like, you know, we're coding along, making good progress. And then all of a sudden, like, that's weird. And it was weird for like 10 minutes. And it was, you know, Postgres date issues. And
oh, shit.
We're like on camera and like kind of like jammed up and like, this is terrible. And so we eventually got through it and got to the end. And then so we're like, okay, well, we can't use that episode, obviously, because, you know, we were stuck for a long time and we look pretty dumb. And so, but we put it out anyway and just posted it on our forum and said, like, you know, we rejected this episode. Is it useful to you anyway? Like, and what do you think of it? And the response was unanimously positive. People were like, we like watching you struggle. It's good to see people actually get stuck. It's good to see how you get out of trouble and like what you do when you don't know what's going on and like the thing is not working like it's supposed to do. And so I think there's a lot of value in both. Like, I think the polished conference presentation has its place. And also, you know, we're just doing this and wow, we're stuck, but like you can see us squirm and how we try to get unstuck.
Yeah, yeah, you're right, yeah. But at the same time, I guess if you were to get stuck on each episode, people will say, well, what the heck? Well, why am I learning from you?
Because
maybe that's kind of the pressure that we put on ourselves as teachers or content producer, right? We want the thing to be perfect, and it's kind of our, like you said, initially said you rejected the video, I guess, because you were not feeling very confident about the video. It's the same thing. I want my videos to be perfect, or I wish them to be. So it's hard when I kind of publish something that I think is not perfect at the same time.
Yeah, and that was my initial impulse, was to, like, you know, hide that mistake basically, or that struggle. But then I've been trying to be better about that lately, especially with new programmers. New programmers don't understand that sort of thing happens all the time. And so like I've seen this with like the people we train in our boot camp. It's like, you know, they get upset because like they're stuck and they think it's them. They think it's their fault. And so whenever I'm in front of a group of like new programmers, I pretty much always tell them like being stuck and having a thing not work that you think is going to work is basically the normal state of a working programmer. It's just like it's going to happen to you almost every day, probably for, you know, for some period of time. Sometimes you get through it in 10 seconds and sometimes you spend a whole day on it.
Yeah.
And so if that happened to me again, I think I would release it immediately without even thinking about it, because I think it's good for people to see that even experienced programmers, even the people that are teaching, have this same experience, and this happens to everybody.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of people are getting trained using screencasts now. So they think like programmers just get, oh yeah, I'm going to write a project. Vroom, here you go. No bugs from
exactly.
The first try, which is not the case. So there's a value. I think you're right. There's value in showing the failures and whatnot. But I guess it has to be properly introduced, right? Because if you show them the first screencast people see is you failing right in the middle, I guess you're going to have lots of upset people and whatnot. So it's kind of touchy.
Yeah, I think you need a balance.
Yeah.
Almost totally. Ideally, it'd be like, you know, you can watch this version where I went through it perfectly, or this version like where it was practice run number 5 and I totally blew it. It almost would be cool to see both those. But like, that's an interesting point you raise, which is like people are learning from screencasts these days that are like highly polished, you know, all mistakes edited out. And like that, and we do that with a lot of our screencasts. And like, you know, if you think back to like Gary Bernhardt's like Destroy All Software, he would do his things like, you know, 20 or 30 takes until they were perfect. And then he would do them all in one shot. And it looks like he's just like flying at like 100 miles an hour through this problem without, you know, needing to think about anything or making any mistakes.
Yeah.
And it gives this impression that like that's how it works.
Yeah, of course.
That's a dangerous sentiment for the industry to take on, I think, especially for new people.
Yeah, so that's the touchy part about screencasts. So that's why also I like to do like live classes too, because people get more. I guess that's also why people pay a much higher price, right? So it's $400. It's a much, much higher price than, let's say, screencasts or books, whatever. It's because people really can see you code and debug in real time. They can ask questions if they don't feel like it's kind of a like pairing, but just one side of it, obviously. Mm-hmm. But honestly, the first time that I did the class, I would say, oh, I'm just going to try it, but I don't really understand why people would like this format. But then as I would do it, I would understand, yeah, there's a value into it. And I started to attend other people's class and would see like the value into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So what is the rough breakdown of your income these days between, you know, your different products and your school and whatnot?
My main part of my income now is the club, the Great Code Club.
Yeah.
But also the classes, but that's the thing that I'm trying to balance, right? Because I'm spending more time on the code club, I have less time to teach my classes. So I'm trying to balance things. Mm-hmm. So what I did recently is last week I did a sale on the recordings. I usually prefer to teach it live, but I kind of needed a boost in revenue before summer. So that's the real reason, right? So let's not hide it. So when that's your income, that's what you make a living and you have a family, you have to find some ways. So I did I thought I'm just going to make a sale and bundle all my recordings, class recordings together and make a summer sale before the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So something that I learned from past years is that during the summer, there's going to be a big fall in revenue, like in the end of June, beginning of July, people are all on vacation. So they're not going to attend a class. So I would try. So usually I would kind of get cut off at that moment and I would just plan to do a class right in the middle of summer and get screwed over because people would not attend. And so I learned from that. And so my approach this year, which has been very successful, is to teach class, but right before people take usually it's like middle of June. After that, it's too late. So you have to do it before the middle of June. So that's what I did with the recordings.
Yeah, I hadn't even been thinking about the seasonal effect of on sales. Like I'm looking at our revenue numbers all the time, and that's a great excuse. It's the summer. You know, don't worry, revenue will start growing again in August. I'm positive.
Yeah, and I think every people that I've talked to that sell info products, the same thing. Like it goes down and you're like, oh man, no, it's done. My business, I have to find something else. I have to get a job. And then you get back to September and boom, it just starts to climb up again. Mm. So it's ups and down. That's part of the game. So you have to get used to it or find some tactics, right? You have to find some solutions to that. So that's what I did with my summer recording was last week. And so once again, it was the same trick that we talked about earlier. Like you put some urgency, like you said, it was just for last week. So people had to buy before Friday and they could save like a bunch of money. So that worked really well.
Mm. If you were going to give a quick summary of advice to someone that wanted to take the route that you're going by selling their own products, what are the most important things that you would tell them up front?
Well, my friend Amy Oi has a very good analogy, and it's stacking the bricks, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of people, they see people that are, well, I don't consider myself I consider some of my parts successful, but they see like some very successful people or some people that are very successful with their product and say, oh, well, okay, kind of the overnight success, right? They see the success and don't see all the work in the back. So before I was able to like sell my first book, I did lots of open source before that. And before my open source, before I wrote Tin, that I got very successful with open source, I wrote lots of open source, which was not successful before that. Mm-hmm. So you have to start somewhere. And I would recommend people, like I see lots of people today try to write a book as their first step into making money online. I don't think that's a good the first step. I think you should start with just trying to provide value to people and try to understand what is providing value. So that's the first thing you should focus on, not trying to make money. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's open source. Maybe it's just writing a blog and providing free advices. You have to understand, like, because it's something that something that you're born with, like understanding how you can provide values to others. You have to learn that skill. Mm-hmm. So you have to either writing a blog, either giving advices for free, like give that for free and understand, oh, now I'm making the life of others easier. And after that, you can try to get a feel of how much that has worked. Mm-hmm. Once you know that, you combine those two, you can make your first product, right? So you know how much values you're giving to those people and you can know how much money you can ask. So you can do some experiment if you want, but very first step is just try to put value out there, like create some stuff that has some value to other people. Try to experiment with new things. And that's the other thing too that I see a lot of people making as a big mistake is they try to, it's good to copy, like we said initially, but don't like just blatant copy. Like each time that I make a product, I do copy from others, but you try to make a twist that is going to make people stop and think, right? So if you just do it's an ebook, like I'm just copying like the other people, they're just going to ignore you because it's the same thing. But if you do a special twist that is a little bit different, it's going to make you a remarkable, right? Just people worth making a remark about.
Cool. I think that's a great place to leave it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. So thanks very much for coming on. It was good to talk to you. And I've been a fan of your work for a long time, so it's nice to finally
likewise
to meet you. Well, thanks. So today's show was produced and edited by Tom Obarski. If you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to thoughtbot.com/giantrobots/105. Thanks for listening.